watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this week
you're tuned to WUS Geneva, WXXU Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. How is it that a small group of people are allowed to decide the fate of a society and those who live in it, and to repeatedly make those decisions in ways that singularly benefit those few? How is it that people allow themselves to be fed lies while being relegated to the role of cogs in a machine that destroys their dignity, yet call themselves free and tell others who demand answers from so-called leaders that they have no right to do so? This week on the program, we'll seek some answers to these questions by examining some of the technologies and methods of social control, the means whereby the few dominate the many, and the many allow it. We'll begin with an interview with George Draffin, co-author with Derek Jensen of Welcome to the Machine. Matt Soltis of Healing the Earth Radio at CFRU Guelph, Ontario, is the interviewer. He asks Draffin what led to his present work.
I've been an environmental activist for many years and resisted getting into economics and politics. We were interested in my case, I was interested in saving the old-growth forests, the ancient forests around the world. But I soon came to realize that it wasn't a question of the U.S. Forest Service controlling what was going on, that politics and ultimately economics and some other levels of society were controlling what was happening in the forests. And so I've focused more and more on political and economic issues, corporate power and global trade and some of the technologies that are used to support those things. So I do freelance research for environmental groups and community groups, public interest organizations, and I'm a friend of Derek Jensen's, and he had heard of some technologies that are used for surveillance and control, and we started doing some research on those, and we discovered some pretty scary technologies. The longer we looked at it, the more we realized that, again, it was the social relations, power relations, and politics that were actually driving the technology. And so we wanted to write a book that kind of looked at what is it that causes humans to set up surveillance and control systems. Why do leaders do that? Why do things seem to lead always to war and security and surveillance? And why do people in society allow it?
Why do people allow it? And how have we gotten to the state where we've allowed so many freedoms to be taken away and not even feel like it has been taken away from us?
That's the central question, and that's what we wanted to explore in Welcome to the Machine. I'm not sure we have any real simple or satisfying answers.
Mm-hmm.
One example is after the events of 9/11 and the rush to war, the question came up, how much security do we need? How tight do we want to make the borders in the United States? How much surveillance should we do of people who come in from other countries with passports? Those questions naturally arose. How secure can we make the country, and how far do we want to go? Is there a balance with privacy? Is there a balance with freedom? I think Derek and I came to the conclusion that it's a false choice, that privacy is actually an illusion. It's a distraction from bigger questions about who's got power over who, from the larger question of freedom and power and how society is constructed and how we live our lives. And as we looked at the historical record, we discovered some pretty shocking things. Criminals, at least from the Middle Ages on, criminals were often tattooed, or they'd even have their ears docked to mark them as criminals. It was a way of identifying people, sorting people, branding people. And about the time in the 1800s, early 1800s, when this began to be frowned upon, democracy was rising and political revolutions, 1848, there were revolutions in Europe. The harsh treatment of prisoners and poor people began to be frowned on. And about this time, fingerprints were discovered. People had unique fingerprints. And also, about this time, photography was invented. And within 10 years of the invention of photography, over 500,000 gypsies had been photographed in Europe. People that were itinerant, they traveled around, they didn't hold jobs, they didn't have property, they weren't under anybody's control. But within a decade of the invention of photography, over 500,000 of them had been photographed in Germany and in Switzerland especially, but in other countries also. And those photographs were put in a file so that they could be tracked. And if there were crimes committed, a database of people that were suspect could be searched. And we discovered that with passports, with any kind of identification, whether it's criminal, it soon becomes applied to the population at large. Any time there's a war, the security apparatus gets cranked up, and then after the war, it never goes away. So passports were used first as a wartime measure, and often to keep draft-age young men from leaving the country. Passports were originally used to keep people from leaving the country rather than for people entering the country. But then by the time of World War I, passports were required for travel in Europe between countries. After the war, those requirements were not lifted. And we see the same thing after 9/11. The Patriot Act was first passed as a temporary emergency measure to protect the country in a time of war, and now, of course, those provisions are becoming permanent. That obsession with security starts out usually during war, during times of crisis, and there's a rationale for it. We're afraid, so we go for security over privacy and freedom. With the passing decades, we lose more and more of our freedom, and surveillance and security and control kind of become the organizing principle of society. Why that is or what to do about it, I don't think that's a simple question to answer, but you can look at the history, especially of the last couple hundred years, of science and military organization being mechanisms for the sorting and surveillance and control of society. It serves that function. As usual with technology, once something's invented and starts to be used, it's never taken away. Once something begins to be used, either politically or administratively or technologically, it tends to become a permanent feature of society.
That reminds me of the term technology creep and how often things are introduced as seemingly innocuous or innocent civilian things, but they really have military measures or whatnot. And I wonder if you can maybe talk a bit about that and how that relates to this whole triad of science, military, and the government.
It's hard to say which comes first. there is technology creep, and I think there's also kind of political creep or agenda creep, where something is invented ostensibly for pure scientific purposes, which personally I think is a myth, but that's often, photography, internal combustion. Look at any invention. I mean, immediately it's used for military purposes. The airplane was invented, and within just a few years, we were using them for dropping bombs and surveillance of enemies. I've already mentioned fingerprints, originally used to identify criminals, but quickly used to sort and identify and control ethnic populations. Same thing with passports, photography, you name it. It's that the military applications of it are soon exploited. And the reverse is also true. A lot of inventions are originally military. I mean, that is where the money where the money comes from. I read some studies in the 1980s. I suspect the numbers haven't changed a whole lot, but those studies said that over half the scientists and engineers in the United States, these are university scientists and engineers, are employed by the military, either directly or indirectly under military contract. The computer, the internet, a lot of things were originally invented by the military for military purpose, and then exploited commercially after that. DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, part of the Pentagon, U.S. Department of Defense, Pentagon, is kind of the far-out science wing. They've got about a $3 billion budget. They're into everything from the software and hardware that's necessary for large-scale surveillance programs to blocking pain and fear, the drugs and other technologies that could be used to block pain and fear in soldiers, so that you'd have soldiers that would feel no fear, no pain, could go without sleep. The uniforms and armor that could be used to coagulate blood so that wounds wouldn't stop a soldier. They're interested in aerial drones, unmanned vehicles, airplanes, cameras, things for spying. They're interested in space weapons. Their genetic research now is being used to sort different ethnic populations to figure out which populations are susceptible to which kinds of biologic warfare. So, I mean, it's just some of this stuff is just scary and insidious, and other things seem very mechanical and, you know, who wouldn't want to block a pain in the medical uses of that? But again, this is being run by the military. So that function creep, what it's going to be used for and who's going to control that technology is more the essential question than can it be invented or, you know, should it be invented. Those things are just never seem to be on the agenda. Mm-hmm. And the stuff is being done in the universities of the United States and Europe. It looks like academic research. It's being done in medical institutes, but it's being funded by the military.
Are you able to talk a bit more about some of the stuff going on in DARPA that I think some people would be really interested in hearing about? Like, for example, the radio frequency ID chips and how the military is kind of combining with consumer agencies and big corporations and all that.
The initial applications of radio frequency ID tags there are in the commercial arena. Everybody's familiar with barcodes, but now there are chips, I think they've got them smaller than a grain of rice, that are actually being put inside items of clothing. And you can do more than scan with a barcode. You can actually track them from several feet or several yards away. You can actually track items, you know, in a commercial inventory in a factory and on into the store shelves. So Walmart has explored putting these ID tags in every item, say in the drug and cosmetics department of a superstore, so that you can track each individual item that comes out of a factory from the factory to the transport system into the retail store. But what happens when people buy it? If each article of clothing, every backpack, every shoe has got one of these radio frequency ID tags, then you know, when you walk back into the store, you could be scanned for your clothing and whatever products you're carrying, and they could direct advertisements that would be customized for the products that you've bought in the past. So it obviously has surveillance capabilities, especially if the radio frequency capabilities are extended, you know, to a greater distance. If they could somehow be combined with GPS, the global positioning satellites, where you can identify an object, a vehicle, or an object or a person anywhere on Earth. I mean, cell phones are like that now. Most cell phones, at least the newer cell phones, you can actually, if you have the equipment, and of course the governments and large commercial entities and the military are the only ones that ever have the equipment and the budget to do it, but cell phone calls now can usually, you can track it whatever specific point the telephone is at. So if someone's traveling in a car or someone's sitting in a building and they make a cell phone call, you can actually pinpoint that location.
Mm-hmm.
And these chips are small enough, I think about 10,000 people now have them, actually have had them inserted under their skin, so the person themselves becomes traceable. And as usual, there's come up with some rationales for why you would do that. Some corporate executives who live and travel in foreign countries where there's some risk of kidnapping have submitted to this. It's been proposed for people that have Alzheimer's disease to put one of these little chips under the skin, on their arm.
Mm-hmm.
And if they wander off, you can find them. Why not put it in school children in case they, you know, they're kidnapped? You can trace and identify and save a child who's been kidnapped. But why not just insert them under the skin of every baby when they're born, and put their social security number with it, and their fingerprints, and put them all on a computer chip that can be read from a distance by the government.
There's always that saying that we have nothing to hide, then we shouldn't be afraid. But what I like in Welcome to the Machine is that you outline a lot of scenarios with encounters with police where all these technologies would work horribly against us. A lot of these things are pretty scary to think about implications for people who won't just sit back and watch a world, go further and further down the tube.
Yeah, it's scary, if it's connected with the military or if it's connected with, one of the spy agencies. These kind of doomsday scenarios are the ones that, really scare people. But I'm actually more concerned about what we do to ourselves, what happens psychologically and socially as we become accustomed to this. We allow it to happen. We buy into the rationale for it. The larger questions of freedom and responsibility and power relations and how society is conducted are no longer even in our awareness. One of the images that we used in Welcome to the Machine is the Panopticon. Jeremy Bentham, who was a lawyer and a political scientist in the 1700s and 1800s in Europe, came up with this. He had a plan. It was originally an architectural plan for a prison. And his idea was that if you had a central tower and the wings of the prison came off that central tower so that the central tower could see into each of the wings, you would have lights on in all the wings of the prison. So the cells of the prisons, all the lights would be on. But in the central tower, the lights would be off. So the guards sitting in the central tower could see into the wings of the prison. They could see into every cell. Every prisoner would be visible to the guards in the central tower, but the prisoners couldn't see into the tower. So you had the architecture, the technology, for constant surveillance 24 hours a day. And again, the rationale, these people are in prison. They're dangerous. They need to be watched. But it's interesting when you read Jeremy Bentham's essays on this panopticon idea. It started out as an architectural plan for a prison, but he quickly realized it could be used in factories. You could keep an eye on the workers and on the different departments of the factories, and why not put it in insane asylums, the madhouses, as they called them then, keep watch on mentally ill people. Why not put them in hospitals and keep an eye on the patients? There could be a central tower in the hospital, and all the patients in the hospital could be monitored, of course, for their own health. Why not put it in schools? So what started out as a blueprint for a prison became useful in practically any institution of society. Michel Foucault in the 1970s wrote a book called Discipline and Punish, where he looked at the panopticon, and he pointed out that it wasn't really an architectural thing. I mean, the building, modern prisons actually are based on something similar to the panopticon, but the panopticon is not really a building. It's a way of arranging society, and the essence of it is that you could be seen. You could be spied upon at any time. Things are arranged so that at any time you may be under surveillance, but you don't know whether you are or not. That's really the scary part, is that when people think they're being watched, they behave differently. They behave the way they need to if someone with greater power might be watching them. But in the end, it doesn't matter if you're being watched or not. You censor yourself. And that's what is really scary. I mean, the Pentagon has got awesome firepower. We see that in the news every day. But ultimately, not everyone can be watched, and not everyone can be controlled. Things need to be arranged so that people control themselves, people censor themselves. And that's the hardest thing to get at, because once you start living that way, you don't even notice that you're censoring yourself, that fear and the ignorance of what's actually going on. Am I being watched? Am I being controlled or not? If you can't tell anymore, then you start to control yourself, and that's when you lose the ability to even know whether you're acting in your own interest, whether you're obeying the agenda that's been set up in society.
It works certainly well. It works in journalism, like all the self-censorship there, and it works everywhere, really.
Yeah, in environmental groups, it works. I have no naivety about the backlash and the reaction that protest, whether it's in the environmental arena, whether it's in the political arena, whether it's in labor organizing. Hundreds of labor activists are murdered every year simply for their attempts to organize the workplace and have some control over their own work. Repression and coercion certainly does happen, but I've seen many more environmental groups destroyed by their own fear and their own censorship and their own kind of rearranging how they think and how they operate and how they make their decisions. They destroy themselves much more efficiently than can be done by repression. That's one of the reasons we wrote the book, was that we wanted people not only to understand the technology, but to understand the power relations and the social arrangements and the political arrangements, but also kind of the internal social construct that people impose upon themselves that become increasingly invisible as you become accustomed to living that way.
Can you explain a bit better what do you mean when you say you see all these environmental groups destroy themselves?
Groups will censor their own agendas, their tactics, their goals in order to get funding from a foundation. They need to raise money to pay staff. Foundations, are reluctant to fund radical groups, so groups become more moderate to get funding. Or groups will be sued by a corporation. I mean, there's a current movie out. I think I'm not sure who produced it, but it's about McDonald's in England sued some activists.
McLibel, I think.
Yeah, McLibel.
Yeah.
This was a case where the people didn't back down. McDonald's sued them for libel because they questioned the health of the food that McDonald's was producing, and they were sued for libel. In many cases, as soon as a group is sued, they'll start to censor themselves. They're so worried about what might happen. The lawsuits often target the individuals as well as the organization, so people are afraid. People are stressed out. People will stop being activists simply to protect their family and themselves, which, there's always a rationale for what we do. I mean, that's another piece of it, is the obsession with knowledge and control. Bureaucracy is essentially the administrative apparatus that's necessary for governing large systems. It first arose in the 1800s and 1900s to enable the administration of industrial systems. You had billion-dollar stock markets and bond markets. You had national and international distribution systems. You had the companies with thousands of workers, and so the administrative apparatus had to be constructed to figure out how to administer such a large, complex system. That's essentially what bureaucracy is, and it involves sorting people, it involves making a system rational, it involves total, information about how the system's working and all the parts of it. It's the setting up and rationalizing of a large, complex system. And that's essentially what has happened in society. So, and it happens in large organizations, of regardless of what the stated mission is. And the Sierra Club and a large timber corporation have more in common than they do differences. Their stated mission is different. One of them is to preserve the environment, and one of them is to cut trees and make lumber. But they both have multi-million-dollar budgets. They have thousands of employees. They have constituencies. One is called constituencies in the environmental group, and for the company, it's customers. But a large bureaucratic administrative system has to be imposed over both of them. And at this point, society itself has become a bureaucracy. There's a myth of democracy out there, and that's what the rhetoric says. That's the mission statement of the United States, if you will, is democracy and freedom. But you'll note how often democracy is equated with capitalism. If you really look, the myth of democracy doesn't hold up. What we've got is a large industrial production system and a large bureaucratic political system. We've become the cogs in the machine. It's not just that the world has become a machine, or that we spend too much time watching TV or using computers. It's that we ourselves have become cogs in a rationalized bureaucratic machine. You begin to think in terms of the same way a machine does.
Can you talk a bit about, we're talking a bit about here, how all this fits into our industrial civilization's larger quest for control? Can you talk a bit about where you see this going from your perspective? Your website is called Endgame, so I think that gives a hint as, I guess, the urgency of the situation right now.
Yeah, although it's I'm actually quite dubious that there's going to be an apocalypse. I think a lot of environmentalists, a lot of social activists start to despair of reform, and they have spent so much time looking at the destruction and atrocities of what's going on that you begin to wish for an apocalypse, an end to the political machine, or an end to the war, or an end to, you know, the destruction of nature. You actually begin hoping for some kind of collapse, and I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, I think we're in the midst of it. I think things are collapsing, but it happens at a very slow pace, which is one of the problems when feedback is constant. When you hear of the environmental crises and social crises and war, and you know, you see the news day after day, it starts to become routine, and the feedback is so routine and so incremental that you begin not to listen to it. So, I mean, we're at the point now where many of the large animal species, wildlife species, are already extinct, and many more are going extinct. We've got a global warming situation that's already underway, and even if we stop burning fossil fuels tomorrow, that global warming is going to continue for decades, if not hundreds of years. The world is a big place, whether you're looking at social relations and political systems, or whether you're looking at environmental systems. Change takes place very slowly, and inertia, momentum is built up. I mean, I'm 51, 52 years old, and I've been in environmental politics and social activism long enough that I've heard species are going to go extinct within 10 years, or if this happens, you know, it'll be the end of the world. And here we are, still here. I think it's one of the things activists need to do is to get over their hope that they're going to see some huge change overnight, or that some kind of permanent reform is around the corner, and then things are going to be fine. Or conversely, that things are going to be so bad that, you know, it'll be the end of the world. That's just not going to happen. I'm in my 50s, and I'm going to die before any of this is resolved. And that, you know, initially you don't want to believe that. You want to see your efforts bear some fruit. You want to see, you know, the energy and time that you've put into activism bear some fruit. But that again is a kind of an obsession for control. And if you read a little history, which we tend not to do, if you read your history, you'll realize that the fight that's going on against tyranny and, you know, destruction and war has been going on for thousands of years. That it'll continue to do so. And in the end, that actually, your motivation becomes a little more stable. Instead of operating in crisis mode, you begin to see that your efforts will make a difference. You know, you won't live long enough to see them, that you're not smart enough, long-lived enough to actually control the fruits of your labor. That is actually very freeing.
I like what you said about that we are in the midst of the collapse, and that it's not something that's going to happen in the future, but it is happening around us all the time. It just happens so incrementally, we get used to it. And that is itself pretty freeing, I think, as well. Like, Derek Jensen talks a lot about false hopes, and I think a lot of people do have a false hope that, you know, 2012 there'll be a massive consciousness shift, or there'll be this industrial collapse. But
we're very fond of dismissing past cultures for being superstitious. But I think if we're honest with ourselves, that there's a lot of magical thinking going on now. We think the hydrogen engine is going to save us from fossil fuels, and legislation to protect our privacy will protect us from, you know, the capabilities of computers to spy on people. And I think that's one of the problems with expecting an apocalyptic doom or a magical saving of the world, is that you begin to put your hopes in false options. The question of surveillance and control, the issues we were looking at in Welcome to the Machine, is, you know, one of the classic false hopes is privacy. I mean, if you think about it, in older cultures, there was no such thing as privacy. You lived in a village. You met maybe 100 or 200 people in your whole life. You knew everybody. And you lived in a village. were in a hunting and gathering band of, you know, 50 to 75 people, and everything was face-to-face. Everybody had essentially the same level of power. Some people were more skilled at some things than others. Some people were natural leaders, but everybody had essentially the same power. And if a leader got out of control, they were no longer the leader, and they didn't wield a huge technological advantage or a huge advantage in information. Someone didn't know more about you than you knew about them. Power relations never got unbalanced to any great degree, and that's just not true anymore. There are people that have vast wealth and vast power over others, and it's not reciprocal. Again, it gets back to those power relations. Rather than looking at the technology or at a particular crisis, I think it's more helpful in the long run to look at how society is arranged and how, you know, even on the individual level, how am I living my life? How do I spend my time? Who do I give my money to? Whose rules do I follow? I mean, ultimately, those are more useful questions. The reliance on legislation, the reliance on someone else is going to pass a law that will help protect my civil rights. The whole idea of privacy never arose. Privacy was never necessary until power relations were unequal. And then suddenly I wanted certain areas of my life to be under my control. So I said, that's my private, you know, that's my private privilege. But why is that even necessary unless I've already given up my own power to someone else?
That's an interesting point. I wanted to say one thing that I got from the book is that I found it interesting that a high-ranking security chief in South Africa's apartheid regime, his greatest fear was not economic or industrial sabotage, but that people would be convinced to disregard law and order. And that was actually his greatest fear, he confessed later on. And I wonder if you can maybe talk about, like, when people hear all kinds of stuff like this, the question that people end up on is, well, what do we do? But I'm curious to hear perspective on that. Like, what ways are there out of this machine?
Jean-Jacques Rousseau, another political scientist and philosopher in the 1700s, wrote that man is born free and everywhere he is in chains. The brain may become paralyzed and the individual still live. A man may remain an imbecile and still live. Slaves lose everything in their chains, even the desire of escaping them. If there are slaves, it is because they've enslaved themselves. The force made the first slaves, and cowardice perpetuates the situation. And there's another writer even earlier in the 1500s, La Boetie. He wrote an essay that's just incredibly inspiring because he points out that that everywhere, kings and generals, whoever's, you know, think of the most powerful people on earth, and how do they get their power? They're still people. I mean, in the end, we are still living with the same capabilities as those people in village life where everyone had equal power. I ultimately have as much power as Bill Gates or George Bush. It's the extent to which someone else has more power than I do is dependent on me granting them that power. Ultimately, you know, George Bush is a human with with one head and two arms and two legs. If he's going to send people to their death, it depends on soldiers obeying his command. Even the soldiers in Iraq, we've got, 150,000 troops? But how many millions, how many tens of millions of people are there in Iraq? So people are ruled by their own consent. And that's true whether you're talking about the ballot box or you're talking about machine guns. Ultimately, soldiers have to obey orders. The population has to obey soldiers. And I think that's, you know, on the political level, on a legal level, on the administrative levels, which is where our minds usually are, that's not a very satisfying answer. You say, well, that's preposterous. George Bush has, you know, led this country into war. He's got power. Well, two-thirds of Americans were in favor of the invasion of Iraq. And those numbers have slipped as the casualties have gone up, as the costs have, you know, become clearer. Those numbers have slipped. But two-thirds of Americans were in favor of invading Iraq. So, you know, do we blame George Bush or do we take responsibility for ourselves? And I think that's really why telling people that they already have freedom, they already have power, is scary. It's not a satisfying answer. We want to hear that somebody, somebody else with power is going to pass a law that's going to protect me. I don't want to hear that I'm already free and that I bear, you know, responsibility for living that way. We don't want to hear it, and we've got a million, you know, political and economic and social reasons why we can't exercise freedom and responsibility. But that's basically what freedom is. I mean, security is slavery. It's slavery to the rules. It's slavery to you know, the military. It's slavery to surveillance. It's counterintuitive, but security, living with an obsession for security is to condemn yourself to being a slave to a machine and to the social relations that machine requires. And freedom is responsibility. It means I've got to take responsibility for what I do for a living, for what I consume, for how I treat my neighbors, for how I elect my leaders and what I allow them to do. And, you know, people shy away from that. People really like leaders and project their power onto leaders, which, of course, is where that power comes from. Mm-hmm. The power that George Bush or Bill Gates or Saddam Hussein or, you know, that their power is everyone's power that's been projected. It's the public's power that the public has projected onto that leader. Leaders are not in power for a day longer than the public submits to them.
A couple more questions for you. Derek Jensen says that you're one of the most amazing thinkers and researchers around. And I'm curious to know how what it's like working with Derek Jensen. You've written a few books with him.
It's challenging. Derek calls me up with an idea like this thing about surveillance technologies, and I think can't remember what the first technologies. I think it was the radio frequency ID tags, mm-hmm. and also the aerial drones. These little, they have remote controlled robots, 6 inches long. They weigh an ounce or two, and they've got cameras that can beam images back to a satellite or to a computer. So you can send these things into buildings. You can send them to sit over cities. Those are the first things we looked at, and so we say, hey, let's write an essay, you know, about these surveillance technologies and alert people to what's, you know, to where their research and development tax dollars are going at the universities. Well, you know, a couple of years later, and suddenly we were talking about bureaucracy and science and control, and Derek's a challenge to work with, because he makes connections between these things. That's how he ends up with, I mean, when he writes a book on his own, it ends up being 800 pages long. I don't have quite the stamina he does, so we try to keep him under, you know, 300 pages, but kind of corralling the scope of it and making it understandable to people with a wide range of interests is always the challenge.
I feel particularly inspired right now, just thinking about how we do always have that freedom and power, but it is really easy when, especially being absorbed in recent news developments and reading about all kinds of stuff, it's really easy to think that, you know, others have more power than us to such a degree that we can't do anything about it.
Well, they do have more power, and, I mean, clearly power is unequal. wealth and power are at record imbalance right now, and you look at what the wealthy and of the world, what is it, 300 billionaires, the 300 richest people in the world have more wealth than half of the world's population. And with wealth, you know, comes political power and technological power and, you know, ability to make decisions. So power is clearly imbalanced. But what I find most useful and most inspiring in my own work is to realize that there's not a certain amount of power in the world, and some people have it and some people don't. The power that I can exercise is up to me, and I can have infinitely more freedom and power over my life than I can imagine right now. But I can only have it if I take responsibility and exercise it. It's not granted by someone else. It comes from my own doing. How far I can go and what I can do and what I can imagine is up to me. And it's not up to George Bush.
Maybe to close things off, do you want to tell people about your website and what kind of service you're offering with that? Because it's pretty comprehensive and vast.
Yeah, people can take a look at my website. It's endgame.org, and it's not about apocalypse and conspiracy. It's about ending the game of believing the illusions that we're fed in school and that we're fed every day in the mass media, ending the game of that power imbalance that we've come to believe is natural and inevitable. We can end believing that. So endgame.org is the name of the website. And I do research for citizens and for public interest groups, environmental groups, labor unions, folks that are fighting for freedom on economic and political issues. So I invite people to take a look at the website and also at Derek Jensen's website, derekjensen.org.
That was George Draffin, co-author with Derek Jensen of Welcome to the Machine, as interviewed by Matt Soltis of Healing the Earth Radio in Guelph, Ontario. Perhaps the greatest of schools' illusions is that the institution was launched by a group of kindly men and women who wanted to help the children of ordinary families to level the playing field, so to speak. But this is not the case, says veteran teacher and author John Taylor Gatto. The talk you're about to hear was given at the 5th annual Link Homeschool Conference several years ago. Scott Frasher of Radio for Peace International introduces the speaker.
John Taylor Gatto is one of today's most interesting writers on education. He has written many articles on the topic and is perhaps most well known for his book, Dumbing Us Down, The Invisible Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling. As a former New York City and New York State Teacher of the Year, John Taylor Gatto has an inside-the-trenches perspective on education, and his criticism cannot easily be written off. John Taylor Gatto points to many anachronisms in history, including that George Washington, with no schooling until he was 11, and then only 2 years of school, could handle geometry and trigonometry that would challenge many college students today. He became the architect of his own estate and started several successful businesses as a young man. Gatto tells us that today, no public school in the United States is set up to allow a George Washington to happen. Washingtons in the bud stage are screened, browbeaten, or bribed to conform to a narrow outlook on social truth. Boys like Andrew Carnegie, who begged his mother not to send him to school, as well as on his way to immortality and fortune at the age of 13, would be referred today for psychological counseling. Thomas Edison would find himself in a special ed unit. His particular genius had been tamed. I should say that the John Taylor Gatto speech that you are about to hear was given to me by a friend on a sailboat who was home educating his children. It was only after I asked repeatedly how his children seemed to be so well educated at such a young age that he then said to me I should listen to the speech and then investigate the difference between homeschooling and home education. John Taylor Gatto was about 70 years old when he gave this speech in 2001.
I'm here today to make you feel good about your choice to homeschool. And since I never did that myself, the best way I can do my job is to tell you some of the awesome secrets of public schooling, of which I know quite a few, the secrets that never get into the newspapers. And when we're done together today, I'm sure you're going to feel even better about your decision to homeschool. Coming west on the airplane from New York, I was reading a surprising book about the fast food industry called Fast Food Nation. Have any of you read that yet? Three or four. Okay. Well, somebody held up a copy of it. Okay. Over 50% of all the restaurant profit in America goes to places like McDonald's and Domino's. And they control pretty much the potato business, the beef business, the onion, ketchup, and mustard world. They're the second largest distributor of toys in the world, and lots of other things. That entire industry, the largest employer in America, was completely built and developed by high school dropouts and otherwise unschooled or lightly schooled individuals. If you read Fast Food Nation, it's an eye-opener. This gigantic global industry was created exclusively by high school dropouts, not a single college degree in the bunch. Now think what that means. A hefty chunk of our gross national product was invented out of thin air by enterprising young people who went on to provide work for college graduates, MBAs, accountants, ad agencies, hotshots, and so on. That's intriguing, isn't it? The bad part is that the food is filthy and even dangerous. I was horrified to learn from Fast Food Nation, now get ready for this, that several dozen people a year, and this is every year, you can chart it like a stock price, drop dead from eating fast food hamburgers, that the potatoes have twice the saturated fat than the meat does, that hundreds of people every year are hospitalized shortly after their fast food meal has digested, things like that. Fast Food Nation, it's worth a read, and I don't get anything for plugging it. Your kids will love it. Do we have that McDonald's thing up there? We have the. Well, put the baby up again. Thanks, Mike. You're probably aware that many schools have already franchised out their fast food operations to McDonald's, Taco Bell, Dr. Pepper, and the rest, and that these foods, including sweet soda pop, have frequently been targeted by medical groups as important contributors to a nationwide epidemic of obesity among young people. Now, I'm no one to talk, but I'm 70, and according to the AMA Journal, 30% of the young people in the country are technically obese. That seems like an awfully high price for our school authorities to be willing to pay for the convenience of outsourcing food provision and making a buck at it. At the least, I think we could agree it's a childish thing to do on this basis, this rationale. Solving one problem in the present by making another problem for the future is like sweeping dirt under the rug or something, and I clearly remember doing that as a boy without ever hearing that you were supposed to do it if you were a boy and you weren't supposed to do it if you were mature. As long as we have fast food and childishness on the table, let me offer another example of the two things. This time the childishness is of the sneaky variety, like talking about one's friends behind their back, which is a childish thing to do because you're not aware that it always gets back to the people you talk about behind your back. I think you have to live a long time before you realize that. In this instance, the circumstances were as surprising to me as finding out that local schools all over the country are willing to sell McDonald's hamburgers when Fast Food Nation says the little meat patties are saturated with fecal matter because of the slaughterhouse procedures the corporation uses. Now, if the guy turning up the burner turns it up high enough, then apparently all the little bugs that live on that stuff get killed, but often they're, you know, ditty-bopping with their friends, and it doesn't, and that accounts for the several dozen people who drop dead from their Big Mac every year. Now, the surprise I'm referring to here is, I think, a little closer to home for parents, and it comes from a speech Lee Iacocca, then the CEO of Chrysler Corporation, made in Buenos Aires, Argentina, in 1993. Now, is it possible that Iacocca could say different things to
to Argentinians than Americans. Not likely, but in fact, true. Iacocca was speaking about using schooling, or education as he called it, as a way to lessen unemployment. I mean, not a day goes by that the newspaper or television doesn't say, you know, if we get better education, we won't have problems of unemployment. But that's not what Iacocca said to the Argentine audience. He said that that was a terrible idea. Try to imagine any American CEO saying such a thing in public in the United States. He'd be publicly reviled. So closely do we believe that the one follows the other. We've been taught that over and over again, haven't we? That good schooling is needed for good jobs, even though the billionaires that own the fast food businesses were lightly schooled themselves. We still hold the school job connection as a secular gospel. And here's what Iacocca said down there in Argentina in 1993. Every word is his. I've changed nothing. I'm bothered by the memory of what happened in Germany. This is Lee speaking. Education was put forward there, too, as the solution to unemployment, and the result was hundreds of thousands of frustrated professionals who then turned to socialism and rebellion. I wonder if it wouldn't be better for the unemployed to smarten up and go straight to McDonald's to find a job. The idea that people who know too much are dangerous is an old one, of course, but it isn't something that American leaders allow themselves to talk about in the open. So Iacocca must have felt himself on very safe ground down there at the end of the world, safe enough to flaunt a little reckless honesty. For if education isn't the answer in Argentina, it's fair to say it wouldn't be the answer in California either. The number one civilian job in the United States is working for a fast food chain, and nobody would be silly enough to argue that that takes much of an education. In fact, if you went down the list of the country's top 10 jobs as published every year by the Labor Department and its predicted top 10 for the next decade, you'd see that education doesn't play a vital hand in many of them. In fact, in any of them, from some perspectives, it only gets in the way. Add that together with Iacocca's warning that educated people are dangerous, and you have all you need to come to terms with the dumbing down of American schools. Somebody thinks it's a safeguard against, what did Iacocca call it? Rebellion. It's very interesting because he's a lower middle class guy from Pennsylvania, which is my own home state. So he must have been taught that idea as he passed up through the corporate hierarchy. This idea that America's corporate leadership has an adversarial outlook on ordinary citizenry is an unsettling notion. In the absence of no more information than Lee Iacocca's sneaky remark in Argentina, I'd be inclined to discourage you from harboring any suspicions that America's children are being held in captivity and dumbed down in some colossal experiment to train consumers early, even if stupid, childish people are better customers for poop-filled hamburgers than educated ones. But unfortunately, Iacocca's reckless remark is not the only clue we have that something is afoot that should cause us all to shudder about the world our kids and grandkids will have to contend with. Three
top executives of Archer Daniels Midland. That's the place that advertises itself as the supermarket to the world, went to federal prison in 1999 for conspiracy. Among various exhibits placed on record by the prosecution was a secretly recorded meeting between Archer Daniels Midland and highly placed Japanese executives in which the president of the corporation said this. This is an exact quote, not a word has been changed. "We have a saying at this company, our competitors are our friends and our customers are the enemy." That's exactly like a familiar teacher administrator saying I heard over and over and over again in different words during the 30 years I spent as a public school teacher. I heard that the kids are animals and the parents are our enemies. I first got wind that childishness might have a political function from James Bryan Conant, president of Harvard for 30 years, high commissioner of Germany after World War II, a top executive on the atomic bomb project, and the father of the comprehensive high school.
You're listening to educator John Taylor Gatto on schools and social control.
In America, a big fish in any pond. Conant led me to the actual purposes of forced schooling in 20th century America. But before we find out what they are, I need to get the important idea of boredom established and out of the way. Could I just get one more transparency? I have special plans for the future first, and then the one that I call hookers in training. Okay. As a boy, my granddad grabbed me by the ears one day when I said I was bored. I couldn't have been more than 7 years old. And he told me that only childish people get bored. I was not ever to say that within his hearing again, that I was bored, because the obligation to amuse myself or enlighten myself was nobody else's but my own. So I was to quit passing the buck. I never forgot that. As a school teacher, I came to discover that American secondary schools are places of exquisite boredom on purpose. The only people who escape are those with a highly developed inner life. But you can't have a highly developed inner life unless you have a historical dimension and an artistic dimension and a philosophical dimension and a number of other inner states that are thoroughly discouraged by the training of schools. Schools are laboratories of extended childishness. Even the advanced classes are maddeningly childish, and as significant as the boredom of young people is the poorly concealed fact that teachers in these institutions are bored too. Their dispirited speech, their low energy, and their constant whining is the giveaway. If you ask school kids why they're bored, they always give the same few answers. They say the work is stupid, that it makes little sense, that they already know it. They say they want to be doing something important, not just sitting around. The teachers themselves aren't interested in what they teach. And that in any case, they don't know very much. And when you ask school teachers the same question, why they're bored, they say it's the kids' fault. The kids are rude. They aren't interested in anything but grades. So how can a teacher be interested? It's a catch-22, you see.